Hello, Internet. Welcome to episode 40 of the Assorted Calibers podcast. The Second Amendment podcast is a little bit for everyone. I'm Weirdbeard, and with me as always is my lovely, wonderful, and very patient hostess, Erin Paulette. How are you doing, Erin?
It's cold down here in Florida. I actually had to put on my winter parka while walking the dogs.
So I said patient because we've been bantering for a while now, and I think you've been ready to get going on the show for much longer than I have. I've been saving this. Is literally the first thing I wanted to say to you is, Erin, tell me about the weather. Because I don't know about you, but right now here in Massachusetts, it is three.
Three what?
Degrees.
Oh.
That's all we got. Honestly speaking, it's been like an hour since I've looked at the thermometer. I bet it's less.
Well, I will check. But when I walked the dogs at around 5:30 this afternoon, it was mid-40s.
Ooh.
Yeah, well, I'm sure that's nothing.
No, that sucks. That's way worse than three here, because the houses and the people are built for three. 40s is fucking cold. Like, when it's, you know, when those first, like, blustery autumn days where it just suddenly goes from, like, the, it's 70 and getting into the 60s, and suddenly it gets into the 50s, and it's like, oh, it's getting cold. And if it drops down to the 40s, late September, and it drops into the 40s, we're like, this sucks. But, again, we've got heating systems and lots of insulation and lots of warm clothing, and we can bundle up.
Yeah, so Floridians, well those of us who are transplants are probably doing fine, but those of us who were either born here or have been here for a couple of decades, we aren't used to that. And so it's, well, okay, no one really cares, but here are my personal guidelines for temperature and clothing. At about 70 degrees, I go, huh, it's a little bit chilly. I should maybe put on a jacket, a sweatshirt, something long-sleeved. At around 60 degrees, it's like, okay, it's getting, you know, kind of chilly. It's like, I'm going to bring out an actual coat, not a real heavy coat, but that is the coat weather with the fleece. And by the time it goes below 50 degrees, that's my cutoff point for, okay, it is now winter, I am cold, I am not going to have any shame about breaking out the parka and the thick gloves, and if there's a wind, I'm going to do the wind mask thing. I will turn into a little Eskimo, because my body cannot deal with that level of cold. And honestly, really, below freezing, Floridians have no clue. It's probably going to flirt with freezing for the next few weeks, but we really don't know how to handle if it drops below and if it stays there, because I can't remember the last time we had snow. I mean, there are apocryphal stories about how it snowed at one point, but it melted when it hit the ground. I really, if you want to paralyze the entire state, just give us a light dusting of snow down to Miami, and the entire state would just grind to a halt. We wouldn't know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
Now, on the other hand, you know what to do with snow, because your birthday present finally arrived.
Oh, thank you. That's a good transition into that. Oh, man. The only problem with my birthday present was my wife was shoveling beside it when I was trying out. You got me. It's a sand toy. But you pointed out the fact that, oh, it can also be used for snow. And I went, oh, it can be used for snow. You got me a duck mold. It's like a rubber duck mold. And I took it outside when the snow was still flexible. Right now, the snow is like concrete. But when it first was coming down, it was perfect snowball snow. And we made 14 ducks that were going across my porch, and now they are currently crystalline ducks, because they've got it rained and then it sleeted, and now it's been four, so they are frozen solid. Like, yeah, you could definitely break a window with these ducks now. But that was so much fun.
I understand your daughter said something cute when she saw it.
Yeah, she said, "Daddy, what's this?" I said, "Oh, my friend Aaron got me this present." And she goes, "This is not an adult toy. This is a kid toy. So I'm gonna take this." And to be fair, it lives in the drawer with her sand toys, so she kind of won. But the drawer with her sand toys is in my house, and as I've told her, when she's gotten cool toys that she didn't want to share with me, I'm gonna be putting you to bed pretty soon, and then I'm gonna play with your toys.
Well, I'm glad it brought you some joy and merriment. I saw that on Imgur sometime last year, and it was like, oh, crap, that is perfect for weird. I have to find it. And it took me a little bit of searching, but I found it on Amazon. It's like, great, hooray. It's coming from China. It'll arrive sometime at the end of January. Well, darn. And then you told me, hey, but I got a birthday in January.
I do.
So, hooray! It wasn't a late Christmas present.
It was a late birthday present.
Yeah.
I don't care. It's awesome. It is absolutely awesome. Well, and also something you may not be aware of, those that follow Handgun Radio know in my drink segment, I am addicted to ice and fancy ice. And probably nobody except for some people who live with me knows that I get obsessive about ice. I've got like spherical ice makers and cubes and all sorts of good silicone ice molds, and I'll start making ice and I'll start making ice and I'll, like I just I love making it. So this is, and this scratches that very same itch, is just the just one more. I'm just gonna make one more. I'm creating. My neighbor was shoveling. I walked over to him and I handed him one, and he just like was like, he thought I was giving him a snowball, and he's like, why, there's snowballs everywhere, who cares? And he went, where'd this come from? This is really cool. And also I think it would add a certain level of class of just pelting your enemies with a barrage of ducks. All right. Well, moving on. First up, I want to give a little bit of feedback. There was on last week's podcast, we got feedback that I was hoping to get. And there was also some feedback that I thought we were going to get on the, I made a big long analogy about sports betting. And I believe, and actually I forgot to look up the case before that, but I think there was a recent Supreme Court case that actually said sports betting is not illegal. So I made this big long analogy that was totally not true and nobody called me on it. What's up with that? Probably because there's enough, I guess there's not a ton of sports geeks that listen to our show. But the other one was that we were talking about with the new background check bill that's coming through, and mentioning that it does not have a carve out for people who work on farms and ranches. And I said, you know, I just got to thinking about the fact that I know of people that are like, oh yeah, no, you got to stay away from that bull. Bulls can get real dangerous. And I realized, geez, I wonder if like, someone's ever gotten to a point where like, oh, a bull gets so dangerous that no, you need to shoot that bull right here, right now before someone gets killed. And Xander Opal, our lovely listener, and he's in the Facebook group, and we met him in Chicago, and he's a great guy, and he grew up on a cattle farm, said, oh yeah, nope. Absolutely, people that if you've got bulls around, there's a shotgun loaded with slugs nearby just in case one turns on you. So that is another nice instance where people who are trying to save us and have our best interests in mind could get people killed. Because, yeah, unless you are the owner of the farm or the ranch hands are bringing their own guns, that would now be illegal.
Huh. I just didn't realize it was a common enough occurrence, bulls going nuts and needing to be put down, that having a dedicated anti-bull gun was a thing.
I think they're kind of like, you hear about this a lot with like the people who, I mean, it's illegal in most places. And libertarian me is like, no, this is good illegal. People get a hold of a chimp for a pet. And
Oh, yeah.
And they have the chimp, and it's cute and wonderful, and it's their best friend, and it's wonderful, and it's great. And then the chimp harms them severely. In the case of, I think it was here in Massachusetts. I know her face transplant came in Massachusetts, but a chimp ate her face.
Yeah, and really what it comes down to is that the chimps are cute and cuddly while they're juveniles, but once they hit puberty,
yeah,
they become really super aggressive.
And bulls are aggressive even as, actually I don't even know, is that there's got to be a term for a prepubescent bull, because I know it's cockerel is the chicken term. I was looking up how to make capons, because veterinary surgery is awesome.
Or is that one wag in high school called it a ballless cock?
Yes. But yeah, it's a cockerel before you caponize them as cockerels. So you want to do it before they reach sexual maturity, and you'll have the best results. There's probably a name for it. I don't know. Xander will be chiming back in as soon as this goes live. Thank you, Xander. But I think I've heard that bulls get ornerier and ornerier the older they get. So they will be, once they are sexually mature, they suddenly become dangerous. They go from problematic to dangerous, but dangerous in a, you know what, be respectful of them and you'll probably be okay, to at some point. And I think it's really, as a general rule, I think like most bulls reach this point. At some point, they're going to get too ornery to even be kept around. I know I was at a diner in Colorado that had a giant steer head or a giant bull head on the wall, and it literally said, yes, this bull was in the pasture, and then it was too dangerous to be in the pasture, so we put him on the wall.
Well, okay then.
Let's see. Another thing from in the Facebook group, somebody linked, I have the article handy to reference it, but I actually forgot to get their name so I can give them a lovely shout out. Oh, it was Xander. So it's Xander again. Xander linked an article that said that the Massachusetts governor ignores court order to reinstate gun permits. And I heard about this story and I kind of skimmed it because it's Massachusetts. Essentially a bunch of people sued the state because they denied them gun permits, even though, and they denied them over misdemeanor charges. And the court ruled that, no, it's misdemeanor charges. This shouldn't be disqualifying. And so therefore, this is a violation of their rights. And Baker has said, no, I'm going to pound sand on that. His statement is that these people have their misdemeanors charges, but they have served over a year in prison because of them. And so therefore these people are disqualified people on the federal level. And so therefore not, he's denying them per quote unquote ATF recommendation. I don't know how true that is. But I will also argue that he stands behind Mara Healey with her assault weapons ban reinterpretation. And, Massachusetts has recreational marijuana, which is illegal on the federal level. So yeah, if that's the way you're going, you're not very consistent on it, Charlie. And I don't like you.
All right, so he is defying a court order. What level is this court?
I believe it's Massachusetts Supreme.
Okay, that's pretty high. All right, this will sound terribly uneducated, but I'm who wins when this happens? I mean, it sounds like the governor is defying the rule of law, the chain of command.
Mm-hmm.
And I would expect that there is some sort of recourse there, but what happens next?
Very little, because the big issue is that in Massachusetts, we do not have provisions to recall a governor. We might be able to recall other people, but I know specifically when we had his predecessor, Deval Patrick, and he was issuing a public apology twice a week. He's a Chicago politician originally and moved to Massachusetts. And, he went right in with the Chicago way as he was redesigning stuff, and he bought himself a new car and was doing all sorts of stuff off the public larder and was getting caught in just the, no, you are just enriching yourself here. So what are you going to do? And there was definitely a lot of talk of, can't we just start a recall process? Like, this is clearly a mistake getting this guy into office. And nope, Massachusetts, you cannot recall the governor. They could impeach him.
Well, you know, I wasn't even talking about that. I was just thinking, okay, if he's defying a court order, can he be held in contempt? Can he be arrested for this? Can he go to jail for this?
In theory, yes. But again, it would need to be the legislator would have to act against him. And it's an anti-gun governor in an anti-gun state. I think they're perfectly happy with him doing this.
Hmm. And I guess there's no chance of this going up to SCOTUS?
I mean,
or actually, it would go to one of the circuit courts first, wouldn't it?
Maybe. Yeah, probably. And I mean, at that point in time, I would argue that going outside of the once you're trying to go outside the state of Massachusetts, at that point in time, just go after the fact that we got permits. It's a poll tax. It is. I have to pay $100 every 5 years. To keep and bear arms. I cannot keep nor bear arms without paying this money and going through this process. And on top of that, I have to, you know, take training courses. There's all sorts of, I mean, it's, you know, I estimated that it probably cost me about $1,000 to buy my first gun. And that's just all sorts. And some people more, because certain states require you to say that you're a member of a club. I might have included my club dues into that because you can't shoot, anywhere around here, because it's all no discharge of firearms. So I need to be part of a gun club. But yeah, either way, that would be the more the route to go, is just get rid of the permits and then all this stuff is moot.
So this actually reminds me of something that I saw floating around the intertubes, a similar topic. This one was in Illinois, where several concealed carry permit holders received a letter indicating that their carry permits had been revoked and they needed to surrender them upon threat of arrest. And the reason for this is because, well, the short version is they received training from an instructor who did not follow the proper procedures for training. And so after an audit of these instructors, the Illinois government, the state police, whoever did this, says that, well, because the instructors did not give proper instruction, everyone they passed should not have passed. And so they just revoked all of the carry permits for every single student that the instructor ever taught.
Crazy.
And so the Illinois State Police is telling them that they have to get retrained by an approved instructor within a certain time frame, or they will forfeit their application fee and become permanently revoked. Now, permanently isn't like, you know, you're forever forbidden from doing
it. Just start over.
Yeah, it just means, yeah, you have to pay your $153 all over again. And from what I'm reading here, the letters were pretty harsh. It wasn't just a, you know, look, we're sorry to tell you this. It was much more of a, you are in violation and you need to do this right now, or we will come to your door and kick it down and shoot your dog and arrest you and take away your warrant.
May I add that, so first up, I will say, you know, in the letter of the law, I mean, that makes a certain degree of sense. The coming down hard on them is clearly an anti-gun state, and how things are done in anti-gun states is the, like, you know, you talked about the, oh yeah, no, I got the, you know, the notice that my permit needs to be renewed. I don't get that. If I just sat around and lived my life, my permit would expire out from under me. No one will ever send any notice to me whatsoever that I had a permit. That I might get notice that, just so you know, you're a gun owner and you have guns registered to your name and your permit has expired for so many months. We're going to come get them. I never even heard. I don't know what happens with that. But they will not tell you whatsoever when your permits expire. That's all on you. And on top of that, again, I am currently still sitting here with an expired permit and a piece of paperwork that says that no, the paperwork is in the works for my renewed permit. And this is like my third permit. I don't think anything's changed. So dumb. But yeah, they just in anti-gun states, if they could do something the easy way or they can do it the hard way, they do it the hard way. Because again, the whole point of gun control laws is to kill the culture of guns, is to make it so, hey, let's go out and shoot guns and have a good time. Let's put as much unfunness on top of that as you can physically do, because that's the bottom line. Because it doesn't stop criminals. It doesn't make people safer. And again, I will note that there's a whole ton of states that have carry permits that just, yep, sign up. We're going to do a quick background check to make sure that you can legally own a gun, and away you go. And then there's an ever-growing number of states that have constitutional carry, where if you can go into a shop and buy a gun, you can load it up and carry it out of the shop, so long as the shopkeeper's okay with that. Some people might be like, no. don't do that in here. And all of these places have no problems. There's no higher death rate. There's no higher mistaken self-defense. There's no things of the, I was in fear for my life and I murdered them. All the horror stories that the anti-gunners tell you of why we need 80 hours of training from a Navy SEAL and rappelling from a helicopter, and the fees need to be $5,000, and it needs to be renewed every 2 years, and it needs to be done in person at the local police station in the lockup. Just all this nonsense that they're throwing, that they throw at us, gains you nothing. The difference between Massachusetts and New Hampshire when it comes to lawful gun owners behaving with their guns is zero. And New Hampshire requires absolutely nothing, and Massachusetts requires goddamn everything. The idea that, oh, you didn't get the right training. Okay, I get it. The law says you need this training. He didn't supply that training. But this is like the ultimate design of malum prohibitum. They're wrecking people's lives and causing them to go through all sorts of hardship for absolutely nothing, because you don't need it. There's no proof that any of this stuff does any good, because, hey, guess what? Training only goes as far as you go. I took, 2 years of French. I can barely speak any French whatsoever. Pretty much my French skill is, if I hear somebody speaking French, I know they're speaking French, and that's the best I can do. And God forbid, maybe it's someone speaking like Haitian French or some of the West African French and all that. No idea. I probably would not be able to figure it out. So, because guess what? I took French. I passed all the classes, and then I never spoke French ever again, and it just went away. And I took Japanese, and I could barely speak Japanese. I took Latin, and I became a scientist, and guess what? I know Latin really good. I can't conjugate a verb. That scene from Monty Python and The Life of Brian, yeah, it's funny, but I can't do it either. I don't remember which tense it is. We had through that. I passed the test, but I haven't done that since. But scientist, I'm doing all sorts of stuff that use Latin names. There's a lot of Latin in science. My vocabulary is still good. My actual translating skills and we never did speaking in my Latin class. It was all just translating. We all did it in the historical sense. But so none of that stuff carried over. Again, you give somebody 120 hours of intensive firearm schools and they do it under duress, and then they get their gun, they get their permit, and they go home and they throw the gun in a sock drawer, they are going to be just as bad as somebody who walked into a gun store and just wanted to buy a gun because they're American and they got a right to buy a gun. No different. Because, yeah, you don't use it, you lose it. Meanwhile, those of us who go through all this because we love guns, yeah, I'm going to go to the range. as regularly as I can. I'm going to shoot. I'm going to teach other people how to shoot. I'm going to read articles about shooting. I'm going to do that. I'm going to take training class, other training classes that aren't required. That's just how it works. So just constitutional carry has the exact same effect as gazillion hours of training. So I think that leads a little bit of another transition point, and also something to talk about in reference to last week. That's kind of the topic is last week's show. People listened to it. People liked it. And there's stuff to talk about still from last week's show. I mentioned the fact that, yes, all right, the House has turned hands, and there's a whole bunch of anti-gunners in control of it, and they're doing anti-gun stuff. So they got their background check bill. The Senate's got the assault weapons ban being pushed through. We'll see what happens with those. But I said, let's not be negative Nancy's about this, because again, there's been many a times when a group has lost their advantage and still succeeded. And so I would say right now, HR 38 is in the House of Representatives, and that is concealed carry reciprocity. And I believe it is the concealed carry reciprocity that was around, was it last year? It was last year. So this is the good one. This is the one that's pretty much, that has like all sorts of good stuff in it on the, if you have constitutional carry in your state, congratulations, your driver's license is your carry permit. It points out the fact that if that state issues a carry permit, it doesn't matter if it's Hawaii and New Jersey that quote unquote issues carry permits, but no, they don't. If there is a carry permit that exists and in theory could be issued to you, you can carry there. And on top of that, if you have large capacity magazines for your carry gun and the state bans large capacity magazines, ta-da, because you are not from that state and they are legal in your home state, you are protected. So this is kind of like when I moved from Medford, Massachusetts to my current town, and Medford was anti-gun and told me we're not going to issue a permit. And my current town said, oh yeah, no, we don't give anybody a hard time with that. Yeah, no, you want a carry permit, you get a carry permit. You pass the background check, you did the course. Yeah, there's no reason for us to deny you. Because of that, all of a sudden, I was in Medford like the very next day. I think it was closing down like our bank account in that town to move to a closer bank. And yeah, I was in there with a gun because guess what? I don't live here anymore. So suddenly you have more power. Now, suddenly all of you people have more power than me, someone in Massachusetts concealed carry permit holder, because you can carry high capacity magazines if this passes.
That's what I was going to get to. I recall last year when it passed the House, but it never even made it to the floor vote in the Senate because I think it was killed in the Judiciary Committee. Mm-hmm. So, again, this year, I mean, it's actually worse because this year the House is controlled by gun-unfriendly Democrats. I don't know if it'll pass.
And I would say definitely this is the thing, though. Call your representatives. Make them kill it.
Make them kill it.
If they need to use their powers to kill it, if they don't want it to pass, make them do effort. Don't let this die on the vine.
Oh, so don't let it die in committee. You actually want it to be brought to a vote.
Yeah, or just push it out. Just call your representatives. Tell them that this is important to you.
Okay, I agree, but what I'm getting at is last year when it passed the House, mm-hmm, and it never made it to the Senate, mm-hmm, people were calling. Yes. And I don't know how we can make Congress do anything at this point.
That's true.
When we had a really great chance of passing it last year, we didn't for some unknown reason. Now that it's a lot harder, I'm very skeptical that it'll pass. I would love for it to pass. Yep. I don't think it's going to happen, though.
But I would say you've got nothing to lose letting your representation know that this is important to you, because at the best, maybe it's going to defy all odds. Because again, yeah, I think it's definitely got the odds stacked against it. It'll defy all odds and get passed, and that's going to make everybody happy. And on top of that, this is national concealed carry reciprocity with constitutional carry recognizing. This is something that murders 90% of all gun control. Because that means that people from Vermont with their guns and their high capacity magazines and their their off roster handguns and all this stuff are going to go to Times Square on vacation, and they're going to be carrying legally.
And that's why I think it's not going to pass.
Oh, absolutely. That's the fair, but that's the big thing is if we can get this through, we all know what's going to happen is that at worst, nothing is going to happen. Crime is not going to go up. New York is not going to turn into the Escape from New York movie. And chances are things are going to get better. Muggers are not going to mug tourists because the muggers are going to mug New Yorkers. They're not going to mug tourists because tourists might shoot them. And again, it just destroys so many of the arguments of we have to do this because it's going to keep us safe. Well, it's not quote unquote keeping you safe anymore. And guess what? You're doing better. What do you got? So that's all. We got to keep some positive energy in here. Let's not be that's what the key thing. And one of the big reasons why I want to bring it up to is I don't want us to be negative Nancy's is there is action to be done and let's do action. Be constructive. Let's not navel gaze.
Yeah. I'm all for being constructive and continuing to nag our Congress critters. I'm just tired and cynical and I don't see much chance of this happening.
I get you. Trust me, I live in Massachusetts. All right. So previously, Aaron was surprised to hear Oddball balk at some knife prices. Oddball responds with a segment on knife price points and when paying more is a good idea.
Welcome to Oddball's Corner Pocket. Former host of the Gunblog Variety Cast, Sean Sarantino, asked in the ACP Facebook group for reasons to spend money for an Emerson Commander or CQC, given that he currently has a Spyderco Delica with an Emerson Wave feature. Looking at Amazon, the Delica Wave is currently going for almost $90, after the recent brand-wide price increase that Spyderco implemented at the beginning of the year. The Emerson CQC will run you about $190, and the Commander will run you $234. I think the real question is, why should I pay so much money for a higher-end knife when I can easily get a cheaper one? As you can imagine, this is a question I get a lot. In fact, my dad recently asked me why I would want a $100-plus knife when a $20 or $30 knife will get the job done. So, let's examine some of those reasons. The most obvious reason is the blade material used. The fact is that better steels tend to be more expensive. I'd love to see $30 knives using S35VN steel, but that's just not going to happen. The steel itself is more expensive than, for example, 420HC, and because it's harder material, it's also more expensive to work on. Higher-end knives also tend to use higher-end materials for their handles. You'll probably see lower-end knives use materials like glass-reinforced nylon versus G10 or micarta for their scales. If you want titanium for the handle, that's going to cost more. You may have noticed that my recommendations for dress knives in episode 38 tended to cost more than the other categories. That's because there's a certain amount of pocket jewelry involved, which requires more work and more expensive material. Then there's pure fit and finish. While I won't fault anyone for carrying a cheap Kershaw or CRKT, in fact, I recommended knives from both of those companies in episode 37 and have happily carried knives from both companies, the truth is that there is less attention to detail on those knives than on knives made by higher-end companies like Spyderco, Benchmade, Chris Reeves, etc. You should expect less obvious seams, defects, and so forth out of higher-end knives. For example, I recently bought a CRKT folding razel. This is a very interesting knife that comes with a unique pocket clip that runs along the edge of the knife instead of the side. Unfortunately, while I was trying to attach the pocket clip, one of the screws that holds on the scales failed. Examining the screw, it was either slightly too short or actually broke off, and the part that was actually screwed into the frame is now somewhere in my carpet. Fortunately, I was able to replace it with one of the screws included to mount the pocket clip. Was I upset? Sure. Am I going to contact CRKT and see if they can help me out? You bet. But the thing is that I paid $35 for this knife, and so I'm not too upset. If I had dropped the $650 that the now-discontinued original version from Graham Knives went for, I would be pissed. And that leads me to the next reason. One of the reasons that I like CRKT is that they make some weird and interesting designs. But they tend to get those designs by licensing them from custom, semi-custom, or other small knife makers. As you can guess, anytime the word custom is involved, the price goes up. And there's always the economy of scale when dealing with smaller knife makers. Of course, these knife makers are also the ones that are trying new and interesting things. Sometimes these things don't work out, and sometimes these things end up being the Emerson Wave, the Frame Lock, etc. Due to patents and other things, you might have to spend more to get these features, at least for a couple decades until the patents expire. Finally, there's place of manufacture. This really is less of a quality thing than political. Simple truth of the matter is that labor in the US, Japan, or Germany costs more than it does in China or El Salvador. If you want a US-made knife, generally you should expect to pay more for that one than one made in China. While I'd like to say that knives that come out of the US are far superior than anything that comes out of China or El Salvador, I can't. We Knives from China makes some straight-up pieces of art, and one of my favorite fixed-blade manufacturers is Condor out of El Salvador. That said, knowing that a blade was made in the good old US of A does warm my heart a bit. When it comes down to it, I tend to use the Buick versus Bugatti comparison. A Buick is a fine car. It will get you from point A to point B. It will even get you there in a decent amount of luxury. That said, it's not a Bugatti. I would say that a Bugatti is pretty much better in just about every way. Of course, it bloody well should be, since it also costs a hell of a lot more. Is that superiority worth the price increase? That's up to you. Of course, there's always a point of diminishing returns. The price difference between, say, a Honda Civic and that Buick isn't nearly as much as the difference between the Buick and the Bugatti. But I'd say that the actual experience difference doesn't increase at that same rate. With knives, I think the extra cost stops being worth it for me really around the $200 mark. Even then, I have to really like a knife to spend much more than $100 on it. Of course, your mileage may vary. Incidentally, when my dad asked me why I would spend more than $100 on a knife, when his $30 CRKT M16 series knife served him perfectly well, I handed him my Benchmade 940-2, which currently goes for about $145 on Amazon. After briefly handling it, he commented that he understood and handed it back. Another way to look at it is the way I look at sunglasses. For years, I was the type that bought the $20 sunglasses from Target and couldn't understand dropping the kind of cash that Oakley's command. Then, at one point, I realized I had broken 3 pairs within 3 months, including 1 pair that broke while I was literally standing still talking to someone. I quickly did the math and realized that I was quickly spending Oakley money on cheap sunglasses. As an experiment, I bought a pair of Oakley's on clearance, and that pair lasted me for about 7 years. If the cheap ones work for you, great. But if you find that the cheap item constantly breaks or is easily torn up and you're having to repair or replace it on a regular basis, maybe consider getting the higher end one. Don't break the bank, of course, but take a step or two up, if you can. It might end up saving you money in the long run. Anyways, after saying all of that, let's get back to Sean's original question. Should he buy an Emerson CQC or Commander to possibly replace the Spyderco Delica Wave that he currently has in his pocket? In my opinion, actually no. The big selling point on the Emerson knives is that they have that Emerson Wave feature, which his Delica already has. The Emersons may be designed to be a bit more rugged, but in my humble opinion, if you break Adelica, you're doing it wrong. And I would assume that it's been working well for Sean since he hasn't mentioned anything. Yes, the Emerson knives use 154cm, which is generally considered a better steel than the Delica's VG10, but not by a whole lot. As for fit and finish, I'll let a quote from Emerson's own website answer that question. Quote, "I've never built the knives for looks or for a fancy finish or for perfection. You'll notice we never enter any of the quality and manufacturing categories at the Blade Show. We don't because we know we won't win." Unquote. By the way, I'll have a link to that post in the show notes. Add that up, and I just don't see a reason to spend over twice as much on either of the Emersons than on a new Delica Wave. If you're merely interested in the design and want to try it out, Kershaw has licensed the CQC design, and you can buy those for around $30. Frankly, the Kershaws look and feel like they're better put together than the real deal. Of course, if you want to drop the cash anyways, this is just my opinion. Lord knows that I've bought stuff that has made others, especially my wife, scratch their heads. Hope that helps. As always, if you want to read more of my thoughts, I write at gunscarstech.com. If you have any comments, questions, or suggestions for future posts, I can be reached at oddball@gunscarstech.com. Or give me a shout out on the ACP Facebook page. Until next time, have a good one.
Now, I've got no problem with people spending up to $100 on a knife. I believe I spent near that much for a K-bar bayonet for my AR-15. Now, I would side-eye someone who spent $200, but for the right knife, I would understand. What I don't understand are people who spend the price of a new handgun on a knife. And believe me, they are out there.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, I've seen them. That's, he talked about, like, the Emerson knife fit and finish, and talking about, like, actually that that some of the quote-unquote knockoffs are actually doing a better job, which is really surprising, because I'd heard good things about the Emerson knives and was like, oh man, maybe I should buy one of them. And I saw the price and went, nope. And I'm definitely, like, strongly in that. Is I don't think I have spent like a, well, no, I think I've spent some big money on kitchen knives. I think I might have a few hundred dollar chef knives. But overall, for like my everyday carry knives, like, I want them to be cheap, because these are knives that I'm carrying every day, which means they're going to get used. They might get lost. They might get broken. They might get damaged. And I want a knife that, like, it gets broken. That stinks. I'm so sorry it's broken. I'll buy another. Or I've got another one already around, because, again, when you're collecting, you know, $20 to $50 knives, you can acquire a whole lot of them just pretty easily.
Yeah, I think the most expensive knife that I carry on a regular basis, well, it's actually another K-Bar. It's a K-Bar TDI that I carry on the weak side.
Yep.
And that one is so somewhere between $40 and $50.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really nice knife.
I love them. I've got, like, so many of them. And I actually, that's one of my, like, ultimate, like, stocking stuffers for people. Like, I'll get him one of those. Because here in Massachusetts, it's just a knife. So it's one of those, like, it doesn't break any restrictions, except if it's a place of the, oh, yeah, no, your 2-inch Swiss Army knife. Yeah, no, that's not allowed here.
In his search for something to fisk, Weird stepped in something disgusting. And when he looked what was on his shoe, it was a catty, snarky, hysterical, but not in a funny way, no, I mean the breathlessly overreacting way, anti-gun article by Vox. Instead of wiping it off and flushing it away like the rest of us would do, Weird chooses to waste some of his precious life by fisking this Vox article. Have I mentioned how much contempt I have for Vox? It's a whole lot. Anyway, here's Weird giving them more time, effort, and attention than they deserve.
So last week, I tackled a story from NPR on guns, and of course they're going to put an anti-gun spin on it. It's an easy way to search for fisk fodder, as is looking at the video magazine site Vox. I've tackled them before in the Gunblog Variety Cast. This week I'm covering a piece by them called How the NRA Hijacked the Gun Control Debate.
This is what the modern gun debate looks like in America. We're so used to hearing from the NRA that we don't really question it when we see them on TV anymore. But talking to the NRA has turned the gun control debate into a confusing, frustrating mess.
A confusing and frustrating mess? How? Generally, when an anti-gunner complains about the gun control debate, it's the fact that there's any debate at all. They would be much happier with us gunnies if we just lie there and take it.
If you go to the NRA's website right now, you'll see the group describing itself as America's longest-standing civil rights organization.
Of which they are. They are a Second Amendment advocacy group, which is a fundamental civil right, and they were founded by Union officers shortly after the Civil War. By the way, the aftermath of that war is really the origin of gun control in America. Many of the laws we have today are rooted in the Reconstruction South, doing their best to keep the now free blacks and Native American population disarmed so they couldn't resist the daily abuses the local governments were leveling on them. I have some great articles on that subject in the show notes, should you be interested.
The NRA really wants you to think of it that way, because it frames the organization as essentially a public interest group.
And why shouldn't it be?
That framing is the reason the NRA pops up in every debate about gun control.
You mean when groups are looking to violate the Second Amendment, the largest group chartered to defend it does exactly that? My, what a confusing and frustrating mess.
If you think of the NRA as a group that represents gun owners, you can't really debate gun policy without them.
Except when you note how little dialogue actually happens between the NRA and anti-rights activists. Hell, you just need to look at the level of insulation the corporate anti-gun lobby has between the lobbyists and the actual public. Go to any anti-gun group's website. There's no way to join or give feedback on how the organization is run or to help guide agenda items. You can donate money. You can volunteer to work for them, as in volunteer to let them tell you what to do. Or you can sign up for a newsletter. Even their YouTube channels have the comment sections disabled and the rating system disabled, so you can't even give a thumbs up or thumbs down to their propaganda. In reality, the gun control debate was really had in the late 1990s and early 2000s, generally around the 10 years of the federal assault weapons ban, and the anti-gun side lost and lost hard. So they've been working hard to not let that mistake happen again.
The problem is
the way they go about this is a charade. It's a fraud. What they're really doing is representing the interests of the gun companies.
Wait, what? Who the hell is this guy?
This is Democratic Congressman Ted Deutch. He represents Florida's 22nd Congressional District, which is where the Parkland shooting took place.
Ah, an anti-gun politician from Broward County, the land of incompetent law enforcement, voter fraud, gun control, and Debbie Wasserman Schultz. We can trust everything he has to say, because he's totally on the level.
This is an organization that receives millions of dollars every year from gun companies. Directly. Millions more through advertisements.
Now, there are a lot of angles where I can rebut this. I thought about looking at the NRA's annual budget and how much money it gets from gun makers versus membership dues versus private donations. But like the guns are only designed to kill talking point, while there are some logical ways to attack that statement, it's more powerful to just simply agree with it. The NRA is a Second Amendment civil rights group that receives large donations from gun companies. So first up, the claim that this makes the NRA the lobbying arm for the gun manufacturers. It isn't. That group is called the National Shooting Sports Foundation. And while I'm talking about the NSSF, I will note that they too will support Second Amendment causes, just like the NRA will support gun manufacturers. Because if we don't have gun makers in this country, do we really have a Second Amendment?
Every year, gun manufacturers donate millions of dollars to the NRA through its Corporate Partners Program. Some of them sponsor specific NRA projects, like Empower the People,
sponsored by Six Hour,
or Love at First Shot, sponsored by Smith & Wesson.
What is Love at First Shot?
I don't want to know.
Oh no, they sponsor outreach programs! Also, gotta love that catty little aside at the end. You don't even want to know what Love at First Shot is? Ironic. Given that this video is talking about the gun control debate, where they are attacking the NRA and the gun industry, and the only outside source they have is an anti-gun politician. As I suspected, their ideal debate is no debate at all. Oh, and if you don't know, Love at First Shot is an NRA TV show that teaches women how to get into the world of shooting. So Vox is anti-gun and anti-woman. And here's another clip to show that they really need to be taken seriously.
In exchange for their donations, the NRA gives gun companies these tacky golden jackets.
It's more of a dirty yellow.
Yeah, that is not gold.
Okay, I don't get the whole country club jacket thing. I don't even know what the proper term for these jackets are. I know there's a golf tournament that gives out green ones. Still, what does this have to do with the topic at hand? And who cares if you think they're ugly or not? This is just mean sorority girl crap. And these are totally the people that need to dictate gun control policy in America.
The NRA doesn't disclose how much money it gets from these donations, but a report by the Violence Policy Center estimates the number was anywhere between 20 and 60 million from 2005 to 2013.
Ooh, another source. The Violence Policy Center, the inventors of the term assault weapon. I quote, "Assault weapons' menacing looks, coupled with the public's confusion over fully automatic machine guns versus semi-automatic assault weapons, anything that looks like a machine gun is assumed to be a machine gun, can only increase public support for restrictions of these weapons." That's Josh Sugarman, the executive director and founder of the Violence Policy Center. This is all totally on the level.
The NRA makes millions more by selling ad space to gun companies in publications like American Rifleman.
Note that they give these magazines away for free with your membership, and these are newsstand quality publications. So can you really blame them for selling ad space? Especially given that every other gun magazine does it too. Never mind magazines like Cosmopolitan that are close to 50% paid ad space.
But maybe weirdest of all, some companies donate a portion of every gun sale directly to the NRA. Taurus buys an NRA membership for every customer who buys one of their guns.
Well, when the anti-gun groups have multi-million dollar corporate lobbying groups that want to remove our rights to own their products and to overall hobble their business, can you blame them for pitching support for a group that fights against that?
Which explains why so much NRA programming looks like a gun ad.
The AR-15 is one of the most effective tools available to protect yourself and your family.
Now, this is a prime example of their total ignorance. If this was a gun ad, it would be the worst ever. The AR-15 is one of the most diversified and mass-produced firearms in the United States. Everybody from the biggest gun makers to small boutique shops make their own AR-15 or AR variant. And they are configured in everything from pistols to pistol caliber carbines to M4 lookalikes. Though I think we all understand the rules on full auto and the Hughes Amendment, right? Even dedicated long-range target rifles and hunting rifles. This would be like saying, looking for a convenient conveyance? Try looking at cars! Even in the sponsored programming, you generally see a lot of guns from those makers when the guns are being handled. But it isn't really discussed. And probably isn't even for exposure of the product. I bet just part of the sponsorship is that the gun maker supplies the pieces to be used in the show. Never mind that, in fact, there are valid arguments for an AR-15 for home defense. Their reaction?
What the?
Yep, more catty mean girls. This is getting ridiculous and running long, so I'll have to tackle the rest next week. Those are your anti-gun talking points and a few rebuttals to combat them.
Fucking Vox, man. Fucking Vox. Why do you even waste time on them? I mean, I don't recall the last time you fished something from Huffington Post or Daily Kos. So why them?
Well, first up, they don't really do audio. I think Huffington Post did some stuff, but it's like super duper short. I need to like chain together like six of them to make one audio Fisk segment. But I just found, number one, this was a perfect article to Fisk because, number one, it was just low-hanging fruit. I mean, really, they were so catty and snarky. Like,
yeah, when you say low-hanging fruit, you were like stooping to conquer here.
Oh, yeah. It's one of those apples of the actual, this is the low-hanging fruit that you don't actually pick because you know that the part that's touching the ground is all filled with worms and ants. But also, again, the arguments that they make, again, Vox, they're not smart people. None of these arguments were smart arguments. Because they're not really thinking over what they're saying. They're parroting the talking points that are just everywhere. And again, that's the whole point of the weird audio Fisks, is it's not for me to topple some massive giant. Although, if I could do that, sure, that's awesome. But overall, it is for you, the listener. Because again, it's also not for me to debate anybody, because none of these anti-gunners are listening to this show. Anti-gunners don't seek out pro-gunners to get their side of you. They don't care. This is for you, the listener, to be familiar with how anti-gunners think, how they talk, and how they address things. And what I think is a good way of pointing out how they're wrong and maybe change their mind. You're not going to change someone from Vox's mind, but again, they're parroting stuff they've heard other people say. That person around the water cooler who's not a hardcore Bloomberg volunteer anti-gunner, they're just someone who's heard some anti-gunners talk. It sounds like a good idea to them. And so therefore they are going to repeat that anti-gun talk because this is a good thing. This is action that needs to be done. And you point out, oh, we need to have more training for concealed carry. Well, except for New Hampshire to the north here of Massachusetts has no training whatsoever. You just, if you could buy a gun, you can carry the gun and they have no problems with this whatsoever. So obviously, no, it's not necessary. And again, all the other stuff that they said. So it was actually a perfect article in that sense because it really was such boilerplate for just the general way of how anti-gunners look at pro-gun people and the NRA.
Again, you just used more breath and more of your life than this article deserved.
Don't worry, there's part two next week.
You know, at some point, I think that you get some sort of strange satisfaction out of this, and I don't know why.
I've got to imagine it's similar to a hunter when they've stalked their prey and taken them down.
So let me draw you an analogy here. I mean, I'm sure you've seen the various revenge things where you can send an enemy, an ex-lover, whatever, like a big container of dog poo, or the gummy treats that are shaped like penises, or a packet full of glitter, or things like that. Just ways to screw with them, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, I have felt upset at certain people in my life where I have contemplated doing that. And then I look at the prices and I say, I would rather have the $20 this costs mm-hmm. and spend it on me than spend it on a petty revenge that I'm never going to see. And to me, what you are doing is that same thing. It's like, dude, wouldn't you rather have the $20 to spend on yourself? Wouldn't you rather take all this time and energy and do something fun? So, all right, you're enjoying it. That's cool. It's just, like when people engage in slap fights on Twitter, okay, maybe you're doing something that's necessary. I'm glad it's not me because I don't have the patience for it.
Well, the one missing factor on this is then I publish it on a podcast and people comment and people are like, oh my God, that was incredible. So, on top of that, third party people are enjoying it. And that is really where the joy comes. I like the thrill of the hunt. I like seeing them and going, oh, this is ripe with just anti-gun nuttery. This is perfect for an audio fisk. And so I enjoy it on that level. But then on top of that, turning it into something beautiful is where people enjoy. That's where it gets magical. So last week, we heard Egghead discuss some of the innovations that the AR-10 rifle brought to the market. Now we're going into a deep dive in some of the other great innovations found on this rifle and why Egghead considers it his most favorite gun.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the General Purpose Egghead. This week, we're going to continue on our discussion of the AR-10. Last week, we talked about how, in order to save weight, Eugene Stoner designed a barrel extension that also made it possible to have a gun that didn't need to be head-spaced every time you changed a barrel. I think that was probably the most influential design innovation of the AR-10, but it wasn't the only one. So, continuing on that line, the AR-10 was also one of the first guns to make extensive use of plastics and aluminum. The original stocks were made of a plastic called Bakelite that was pretty common in the time. You actually saw it in a lot of household stuff, like you saw it in things like phones and stuff like that in households at the time. That and the aluminum receivers made the gun have a kind of toy-like feel to users that are used to guns made of steel and wood, partly because the gun was just so dang light. The original AR-10 prototype, which is a 308 semi-automatic, mind you, weighed less than 7 pounds, unloaded, and for comparison, the M1 Garand at the time weighed 9.5 pounds. Not only was it lighter, but it also had a 20-round detachable magazine and comparable ballistics to the M1, so greater than doubled capacity for less weight. The magazine, by the way, had a ridged pattern that enhanced strength for less weight in materials and was referred to as a waffle mag because of that cross-hatched pattern. Even being as light as it was, though, it was also more mild in recoil than you would expect, because of Stoner's last innovation, which is the combination of the direct impingement gas system and a stock that was in line with the barrel and kept all of the moving parts lower on the gun. This is similar to the concept of a lower bore axis on a handgun. What happens here is a simple matter of leverage, right? When you fire a gun, you have a lot of parts that move backward and create some recoil. And however far above your arm that recoil is, if it's a handgun, or above your shoulder, if it's a rifle, wherever you anchor it on the body, however far above that level that force is applied to, the more leverage it has and the more it wants to flip upwards. If you take the barrel and all of the moving parts and put them lower down, instead of the gun wanting to rise upwards as you shoot it and feeling kind of flippy or having a lot of muzzle rise, it tends to push more straight back into your shoulder and feels softer shooting. So a traditional stock is slightly bent, right? And this is in order to bring the barrel closer to your eye level, and your sights are typically right on top of the barrel. This probably comes from early guns where we would pretty much sight down the barrel to shoot it without using much in the way of sights. Maybe you had a front bead or you had some really primitive notch sights. With modern manufacturing, it wasn't really any problem to create sights that were high enough to be in line with the shooter's eye and were still very level and capable of being accurate and also strong. So Eugene Stoner used this new style of stock to reduce recoil. Now, your sights are much taller above the barrel than they would be in a traditional rifle, but this isn't actually a disadvantage. It actually can be an advantage. You have what you refer to as point-blank range with guns, which is the maximum distance at which you don't have to adjust your sights to hit your target. This is mostly influenced by the ballistics of whatever cartridge you happen to be firing, but it's also affected by your height above bore for your sights and also your zero distance. Anytime you fire a gun, you have a period of time where the bullet is rising relative to the axis of your sights. You have a near zero where the bullet first crosses your sight line where you zeroed the rifle. You have a period of time where the bullet impacts above where your sights are aiming, and then a far zero where it crosses that sight line again, and then it just continues to drop from there. You could have a special case where the bullet just barely touches the sight line and then comes back down, where your near zero and far zero are in the same place, but usually there's a period of time where the bullet is above the sight line as well. If you have a gun with sights that are higher above the bore, the angle between the sights and the barrel is a little bit steeper, so the bullet is rising a little bit faster, and it's rising for a little bit longer time relative to your sights, and it might stay above your line of sight for a little bit longer and go a little bit higher above your line of sight before returning back to zero and then falling back beyond it. So that slightly higher sight height and that increased angle between the barrel and the sights can give you a slightly longer distance where your bullet is pretty close to where you're aiming in terms of impact. It's not a huge advantage, but it is one potential advantage, and it at least goes to show that there's no particular advantage to having your sights as low to the bore as they can be. So Eugene certainly wasn't afraid of having to raise your sights a good 2.5 or 3 inches above the barrel. One thing he had to account for, though, is that now my sights are above the barrel, and they're kind of sticking out quite a bit. So they need to still be fairly strong so they don't get banged off of the gun or adjusted off of zero if they get dropped. So he constructed a triangle, which is one of the strongest, simplest shapes. They use it in bridges and trusses for a reason. It's very good at bearing loads. So you have a triangular front sight post for additional strength, and your rear sight, instead of being just a plain triangle, is kind of an extended triangle, kind of a trapezoid, because why not? Let's extend it and have enough room to stick your hand in there and have a little carry handle. This way you can have an easy way of handling and carrying the gun without having your finger near the trigger. It's probably not worth putting a carry handle on a gun just out of nothing, but if you're going to have the sights sticking up that far and you're going to have a little triangular thing to make sure that the sights don't get knocked off, might as well make it do something. In addition, the early models of the AR-10 made use of this little space by fitting the charging handle up there in a sort of upside-down trigger that would reciprocate inside the carry handle space. Later on, with the AR-15, it got moved to the familiar position we all know and love at the top rear of the receiver, directly above the stock. So in addition to moving the barrel lower and the sights higher, right back up in line with the shooter's eye, Eugene also got rid of more moving mass above the barrel by not using a traditional piston system and instead going with direct gas impingement. Instead of a long rod slamming back and forth above your shot, and you're welcome for that line, Aaron, you remove all of that and you just channel the gases directly back to cycle the bolt. This reduces recoil further because you have less mass moving back and forth higher above the shooter's shoulder, sort of similar to the bore axis problem. But it does make your gun run much dirtier. This is a pretty controversial move, still is. A lot of people don't like how dirty the AR runs, which is why piston AR uppers are so terribly popular right now. Personally, I don't really see the need for a piston upper. I find that ARs are absolutely reliable with reasonable maintenance schedules. If you start with a clean gun in good condition, and your ammo is any reasonable quantity, it's pretty hard to shoot enough ammo to gum up your gun without having it be so much ammo you couldn't even carry it. You can be completely loaded down with as much ammo as you can carry, and you're going to run out of ammo before your gun starts to jam before it gets gunked up. Just maintain your gear at reasonable intervals and you'll be fine. But that's just my two cents, and I'm not a light machine gunner by any stretch of the imagination, so opinions may differ. Lastly, one additional weight-saving measure was included in the AR-10 at George Sullivan's insistence and above Eugene Stoner's objections. This was an ultralight fiberglass-wrapped barrel, which is similar to the aluminum-sleeved steel barrel of the AR-1 or the polymer-sleeved steel barrel of the AR-7, kind of a similar idea to previous Armalite guns. I saved this for last because it ultimately kind of proved to be the undoing of the AR-10 platform. And maybe this is why Sullivan isn't credited for the AR platform nearly as much as Stoner. Because when the AR-10 was submitted to the government, it was in trials to replace the M1 Garand, and this fiberglass barrel failed pretty catastrophically and exploded. So the government quite understandably ended up going with a different platform, and we ended up with the M14. Going back to the history, though, despite that failure, the government liked the new design. They felt it had promise. So they suggested that it be modified and submitted to the Air Force in trials for their new weapon, which was going to use a new, lighter, less powerful cartridge. And I suppose it seemed like a pretty fitting match for a gun that was designed so much around reducing weight to begin with. There's a lot more after this, but to make a long story short, the AR-10 got scaled down to 223, and the AR-15 was born. So personally, I understand why the military went with 5.56. With their weapons, especially running full auto, they're going to go through a lot of ammunition a lot faster than someone with a semi-auto in the civilian world might expect to. And for the military, it's far more important that they have ammo left to shoot rather than to worry about how powerful each shot is. And the 5.56 is about as light and small as you can get without sacrificing a lot of range, and it still contains an acceptable level of power. Personally, though, I'm never going to own a full auto. And I would probably prefer to stay with Stoner's original AR-10. The AR-10 is kind of my choice for a one-do-it-all rifle, a sort of modern scout rifle. It's light enough and agile enough that it can be used like an AR-15, albeit a slightly beefier one in a defensive scenario. It still has the power for hunting, and it's an inherently accurate gun, and with a good barrel can be a real tack driver for target shooting. So it is a rather old design, but one that I really appreciate and I think was revolutionary in its time and still has a lot to bring to the table. And that's more or less why it's my favorite. So that wraps us up this week, and thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.
I'm not sure if I should feel flattered or called out for that visual. But thanks, I think.
He sure does have a way with words, doesn't he, Aaron?
Jeez. So when he called it his very favorite gun, really my first reaction was to ask if he's named it Vera.
Is my very favorite gun.
I gotta wonder if his AR-10 has a name.
She has a name.
So does this. I call it Vera.
Not specifically about the AR-10, but when he was talking about the early design philosophy and the carry handle and the charging action up top, like the little trigger, when you and I went to the NRA annual meeting in Dallas and we went by Brownells, where everything was like really retro, mm-hmm. and you just completely nerded out. You went gay for these guns and you were just goobering out about the carry handle and the charging thing, whatever that is called, up top.
Yeah.
It was so cute the way you were just having a total weeb moment.
Well, it's one of those things that I'd always seen in books reading about the AR-10, and I'd never actually handled one and actually be able to feel that charging handle, because when you finally get your hands on an AR-10 or an AR-10 pattern rifle, it's just a big AR-15, which is well and good. I will also say his statement about 7.62/308 being like the go-to, like that is my rifle cartridge. And I like it for the exact same reason is, yes, 223 is awesome. Again, I'm a reformed caliber warrior. Yes, there was a time when I called it the poodle shooter. I was wrong. I'm sorry. But the fact that it is much more of an all-round cartridge is that one cartridge will do most things for you, as opposed to the 5.56, which is much more specialized for, it is very good for anti-personnel, smaller game, etc.
Thanks to each and every one of our listeners, and a very special thanks to all our supporters on Patreon. To become a Patreon patron, go to patreon.com/assortedcaliberspodcast to sign up. Patrons get an early release of the podcast, plus bonus content like our hilarious blooper reels, the ACP film tracks, and the ACP mag dump.
You can get more from me at my blog, which is weirdworld.com. That's W-E-E-R-D world.com. And hear me weekly on Handgun Radio on the Firearms Radio Network.
You can get more from me at lurkingrhythmically.blogspot.com, bluecollarprepping.blogspot.com, pinkpistols.org, and blazingsword.org.
Thanks to Nate Spencer for our music.
I'm a magical cartoon talking pony, and he's just a little horse. Our species are assorted, and so is our podcast. Good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody.